From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Obama draws a connection between ISIL and terror threats at home.
We got to improve our surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence there. Special forces are going to have a role. And there are going to be times where we take strikes against organizations that could do us harm.
Mixed signals are emanating from North Korea. Experts say Pistorius had no mental illness on the night of the killing. A look at the impact of plastic on the world's ecosystems and tips to ease daily wardrobe stress. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Iraqi warplanes carried out airstrikes overnight on the northern city of Tikrit as they battle to regain control from Sunni militants who have declared the formation of an Islamic State across areas of Iraq and Syria. Fighting continued today in Tikrit, one of several cities where militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant took control in a surge beginning in early June. U.S. President Barack Obama says terrorist-fueled militancy in Iraq and Syria is boosting an already omnipresent threat to America's security at home. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Washington.
Iraq's beleaguered military launched an offensive against Sunni extremists in the northern city of Tikrit as a shipment of Russian military jets arrived in the country that could give the armed forces a tactical edge going forward. While the bloody sectarian conflict rages on, President Obama said the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant is attracting radicalized militants in both Iraq and Syria who could pose a threat to the United States.
They're gaining strength in some places. We've seen Europeans who are sympathetic to their cause traveling into Syria and now may travel into Iraq, getting battle-hardened. Then they come back. They've got European passports. They don't need a visa to get into the United States.
The situation calls for preemptive measures, according to Republican Congressman Peter King.
You need to be very aggressive on this. Syria is our biggest threat right now, because not only are there thousands of Europeans who have visas sent to the United States going to Syria, there's also at least 100 plus Americans who are over there in Syria right now. So any of these people can go back to the United States and they can carry out the type of attack that they're being trained in Syria.
The United States stands ready to act, according to President Obama.
Now we're spending a lot of time, and we have been for years, making sure that we are improving intelligence so that we can respond to that. We got to improve our surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence there. Special forces are going to have a role. And there are going to be times where we take strikes against organizations that could do us harm.
Heightened security measures are expected to be on display later this week during the July 4th Independence Day holiday. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
In mixed signals emanating from North Korea, Pyongyang today called for a cancellation of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises to promote an atmosphere of reconciliation ahead of September's Asian Games to be held in South Korea. Meanwhile, the North confirmed today it fired two short-range ballistic missiles Sunday into waters off its east coast and through the Sea of Japan. Pyongyang also announced two detained Americans, Matthew Todd Miller and Jeffrey Edward Fole, will be tried on charges including hostile acts against the state. They were both apprehended in April. Korean-American Kenneth Bae, arrested in November 2012, is currently serving a 15-year sentence at hard labor on similar charges. Efforts to secure Mr. Bae's release have been unsuccessful. A 75-year-old Australian, John Short, was detained for nearly 2 weeks in March after being accused of distributing religious literature. He was deported. Last year, an 85-year-old Korean War veteran, American Merrill Newman, was held for more than a month. Malcolm Cook, a senior fellow at the Singapore-based Institute for Southeast Asian Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, North Korean authorities have been arbitrary in charging foreigners accused of wrongdoing.
The North Korean explanation for leniency was his age, and that may very well be the case of the 75-year-old, whereas Kenneth Bae, the third American who's incarcerated in North Korea, has been in jail for similar alleged activities for getting up to 2 years. So I guess it's a case-by-case approach, but certainly in the case of both the 85- and 75-year-old, their age and physical condition may have been a factor.
There were some preliminary efforts, anyway, to try to release Kenneth Bae from prison. They've all obviously failed. With three Americans potentially in jail in North Korea, is Pyongyang sending Washington a message?
There have been arrests of Americans and other foreigners repeatedly, and at times, and even in the case of the Americans, when especially high-level visitors were sent or emissaries who have high public profile, they were successful in gaining the freedom of their incarcerated nationals. In the case of Kenneth Bay, similar attempts have been made and with no success. It certainly does show that the new regime under Kim Jong-un, the young grandson of the founder of North Korea, is taking a seemingly a tougher and in some senses harder to relate with approach. We might expect that these two new people may spend longer in North Korean incarceration than has been so in the past.
Do you see any linkage with the pending visit to South Korea this week by China's President Xi Jinping, who will not visit North Korea, as Chinese leaders have done so in the past?
The timing of it is certainly North Korea certainly likes to gain international attention, usually through these types of acts when there are meetings between South Korean leaders and other leaders that North Korea would not support. So I'm sure both the firing of the three short-range missiles and potentially the announcement of these two arrests might be tied. I don't think the arrests themselves, though, are.
President Xi will visit South Korea, as we mentioned, without visiting North Korea. He's going to hold talks with President Park Geun-hye. How significant is his trip to South Korea?
It's the first time that a new Chinese leader has visited South Korea before North Korea. Of course, China only recognized South Korea about 20 years ago. Until 20 years ago, there was no diplomatic relations. In the case of Kim Jong-un and North Korea, China had invited him to visit China pretty much immediately when he became the new leader. So the fact that there hasn't been leader-to-leader talks between China and North Korea has much more to do with North Korea and its new, somewhat unpredictable leader than China, I think.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said today he sees no linkage between President Xi's trip Thursday and Friday to South Korea and the North Korean missile tests. He says China maintains good relations with both Koreas and urged all parties to make efforts to reduce tensions. China's state-run Global Times warned today those behind Hong Kong's 10-day unofficial referendum on democratic reform threatened to divide the people of the special administrative region, adding that political confrontation does nobody any good, saying it will not bring about democracy, but will only shake the region's foundation for practicing democracy. Vote organizers say nearly 800,000 people cast ballots, mostly online, but also using a smartphone app are assessing a voting booth to be allowed to select the next chief executive, the territory's top leader, who is to be elected in 2017. However, Hong Kong's basic law stipulates all candidates must be approved by a nominating committee. China's white paper issued in mid-June underscored the unique one-country, two-systems arrangement, that is, whereby Beijing permits to a degree of autonomy, that while China retains comprehensive jurisdiction over the territory, urging patriotism to the country and warning that it will not allow chaos in Hong Kong. RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harrell tells VOA's Victor Beatty the white paper may have played a part in awakening the concerns of Hong Kong residents over the future of democracy in the territory.
Beijing has been struggling to adapt to the political realities of a Hong Kong where the population is increasingly aware of political life, aware of the differences between the normative or ordinary life of Hong Kong political life versus political life inside the Chinese mainland. And China's finding that its approaches for dealing with Hong Kong, whether in terms of outright intimidation through the white paper or the appointment of pro-Beijing politicians, or even what is widely suspected to be a campaign of covert manipulation through replacement of critical media voices with more pliable media voices and leveraging of triads to deliver messages to those who don't get in line, are not succeeding in cowing the Hong Kong people. Instead, they've only incentivized them to stand up more to what by essentially revealing that the threat is real.
Does it matter that nearly 800,000 people cast ballots in this election?
It definitely matters. I mean, I think what it shows is that the population of Hong Kong is increasingly politically active and disposed to expect a role in their own governance. There is an expectation that 2017 will result in a real, genuine democratic election accountable to the people of Hong Kong and coming from them with candidates who are put forward by Hong Kongers, not by Beijing, and that this will be conducted according to international standards.
Do you think China will allow selection by the voters of the chief executive?
In the past, it seems to be the case that when Hong Kongers have shown a very strong, united position on an issue, Beijing has taken that on board and adjusted appropriately. Think back to the national security law discussion back in the mid-2000s. And it is certainly possible, since it's so clearly in Beijing's interest not to have the worst-case outcome here, of either turning Hong Kong fully against the mainland in some sense or of having to use force. China benefits from having a Hong Kong that is stable, economically prosperous, and at least in many important ways, happy or willing to accept Beijing's writ. If the relationship becomes highly contested, if Beijing appears too ham-fisted or ham-handed and approaches it with an intent to try to cow Hong Kongers or intimidate them repeatedly, that relationship will just become more costly and less effective from Beijing's perspective. So I think that it is possible that Beijing will do this. It's simply up to them to now take this on board and adjust effectively.
Harold says he doubts China will resort to a violent Tiananmen Square-type crackdown, in part because pro-democracy activists who are part of the Occupy Central movement have so far shown skill in taking the moral high ground and avoiding antagonizing Beijing. He says both sides know the relationship is long-term and neither would gain from a confrontation.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
A report by mental health experts says South African runner Oscar Pistorius was not affected by a mental defect or mental illness when he fatally shot his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp. The athlete's murder trial resumed today after being on hold for a month while he underwent evaluations by a team of psychiatrists and a psychologist. The court ordered the tests after a defense witness testified that Pistorius had an anxiety disorder that could have contributed to the shooting last year. Prosecutor Geir Nell read two passages from the panel's report today and says there was no mental condition that would have prevented Pistorius from being criminally responsible for the shooting. Both Nell and defense attorney Barry Rowe said both sides accept the basic findings of the report, but each said there may be individual factual statements they may want to contest in later testimony. The UN Children's Fund says Sudan today is home to one of the biggest children's crises in the world. UNICEF warns conflict, displacement, and underdevelopment are putting children at risk of death, disease, and disability. Geert Capilera of the UN Children's Fund.
Of course, we have also still the war going on in the southern states of Sudan, the Kordofan states, Blue Nile, where we have an estimated 500,000 kids we haven't been able to access for the last 3 years. We haven't been able to access because a very active conflict going on between the government of Sudan's forces and the SPLM North, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement Army, but the northern sector.
Capilera says the children in these states have not been vaccinated against killer diseases and are at high risk. He also said chronic underdevelopment in Sudan is hitting children hard throughout the country.
800,000 children today are acutely malnourished in Sudan. And what is interesting is that a majority of these children are not in the conflict-affected areas. A majority of these children are in the east of the country that has been spared of much conflict over the last decade. So the reason for that malnutrition is not conflict-related. It has much more to do with an underinvestment in basic services.
Caballero also noted that children are being deprived of education. UNESCO reports 58 million children globally are not in school. 2 million of them are living in Sudan.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
It is difficult to imagine a world without plastic. Plastic keeps our food fresh and protects medicine. It is used in all kinds of consumer products, from electronics to fountain pens. But while plastic is a $374 billion industry in the United States alone, it also has become a major global environmental headache, littering roads and contaminating waterways. In this report, VOA's Roseanne Skirbel considers the impact of plastic on the world's ecosystems.
As World Cup play continues across Brazil, the country is gearing up to host the 2016 Summer Olympic Games. Among the concerns is that the sailing venue near Rio de Janeiro is too polluted to hold any event, says local biologist Mario Moscatelli.
As autoridades brasileiras parecem que vivem num mundo paralelo.
Moscatelli says government authorities don't see trash accumulating in the mangroves and certainly aren't managing it. The same story is playing out globally in a trail of plastic that washes from roads into streams and rivers, eventually making its way to beaches and oceans. Over time, it accumulates in the water column and never goes away. That's because plastic is synthetic. It doesn't biodegrade. It simply breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces, says Nancy Wallace, who heads the Marine Debris Program for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
There's chemicals in plastic that can leach out into the oceans, but then there's also a lot of chemicals and pollutants in the ocean. So things like DDT that are outlawed now, but they're legacy compounds that are still in the ocean, they will go onto the plastics because of the properties. And because of that, then they're on those plastics when those fish are ingesting them.
Potentially moving dangerous toxins up the food chain back to human consumers, Wallace says. Humans cause the problem, and humans can solve it, she adds.
By using less single-use items, by recycling our items, by disposing of those properly and making sure that they're going where they should be going, we can really make a huge difference. It's really about caring about the environment and knowing that we are the ones that impact it.
Plastic accounts for $13 billion in damage to marine habitat, according to a United Nations report released at this week's Environment Assembly in Nairobi, Kenya. Richard Madison is CEO of Trucost, the company that calculated those figures. Speaking by Skype, he points out that the report promotes an alternative, a business model that opens new markets for sustainable plastic products.
You could, for example, replace the use of virgin raw materials for plastic, which is oil, with bio-based products. You could reduce the energy intensity of plastics production by using renewable energy sources. We could reuse bottles in our households many, many times over if we wish to, rather than just bin it after a first use. We could, when we get rid of that plastic, recycle it and reuse it, which replaces the need for virgin raw materials.
The report calls for companies to better measure, manage, and disclose information about the use and disposal of plastics, says Andrew Russell, director of the Plastic Disclosure Project, which released the report at the Nairobi meeting.
We see the opportunities for them to save money, quite frankly, and we also see them to be much more aware, much more cognizant of risks they face in the environment from a reputation perspective or from a regulatory perspective. And if they think about plastics the same way they do other things, then I think these opportunities will present themselves.
Russell says that by putting a new value on plastic, industry has an incentive to help clean up the environment, but adds that all sectors of society must join to address the problem. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
You jump out of bed. You're rushing to get ready for work. You look into your closet for what to wear. And with the first issue of the day, you're stumped. Well, we may have a little help for you today. I begged style consultant Ashley Martini to share some of her tips for wardrobe stress.
Absolutely. There are so many different things that we can do to make this process easier in the morning. I say, first off, try to plan the night before. And if you feel like every night you don't have the time, maybe on Sunday, spend, 20, 30 minutes just getting organized for the week, putting a couple outfits aside, try them on in advance so that you don't put them on and realize that there's a stain or something doesn't fit properly. And just be prepared. By being organized and prepared, things will definitely flow much easier.
And not all styles work for all people. Like, I see women on the runway, I could never wear that stuff to work.
I know. This is a huge issue of a lot of us looking at what's on the runway and wanting to be on trend and on point that season. And what we really have to focus on is identifying our body type, educating ourselves on our body type, and then learning what's flattering and what works for our body type, not what's on trend and not what's on a very thin model on the runway. It just doesn't work for our real bodies.
Could you give us some information on what type of bodies there are and what might work with what type of body?
Sure. There's six basic body types: triangle, inverted triangle, rectangle, apple, diamond, and hourglass. And in my book, there's tons of tips on how to dress these body types for all different occasions. And, there's just, tons of different ways once you identify which one of those you are. And for example, let's talk about triangle body type. Triangle body type is much more narrow above the waist and much larger on the bottom. So you want to do things to create a more proportioned look by drawing the eye to the upper part of the body. So you could do this with an interesting neckline, a statement necklace, something with shoulder pads to create more of an illusion that you're more balanced.
And talk about the men for a moment. I look at these fashion things, and some of these outfits for men are just outrageous these days. No shirt, a shirt with a lot of holes in it. What is appropriate for a business, business effort for a man?
Right. Well, in speaking to the holes in the shirts and things like that, a lot of the popular trends now are all like, different relaxed, stress-free, laid-back, sort of effortless, sort of distressed clothing. So that's where the holes all come into play. Now, when it comes to being in the office, completely inappropriate. If you want to do that and you're going to the beach or you're hanging out in a casual setting, that's fine. But when you're in an office, I believe, and I preach this to the staff at my husband's office all the time, and he's a lawyer, that everyone needs to be in a suit and everyone needs to look clean and polished and professional.
And the bottom line comes to that dollar. You can spend a lot of money on clothes, but do you really need to do that to look professional in an office setting?
Absolutely not. This is a huge misconception in society that, we have to spend a lot of money to look great. That's totally not right. There's so many different, stores and options for everyone out there within any budget, and I truly mean any budget. I work within all budgets. I mean, I just was at Kohl's last week and found tons of great items, and they had blazers, pants, everything you can imagine.
So once again, what's the name of your book?
Style Teeny, Shake Up Your Style, Stir Up Your Confidence.
I think that's cute. And who's your publisher so they can find out how to get it?
Brookline Press.
Okay, thank you so much, Ashley, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ashley Martini, style consultant, author, and founding member of Martini Fashions. Thank you for joining us for International Edition. We will be losing some of our shortwave frequencies today. However, you can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History.
On June 30th, 1785, the British military leader and philanthropist James Oglethorpe died. He is best known for leading a group of settlers who founded the colony of Georgia in North America. On this date in 1860, just 7 months after the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, several prominent British scientists and philosophers held a debate at Oxford University on the then-new theory of evolution. Among the participants were scientist Thomas Henry Huxley and Bishop Samuel Wilberforce. Bishop Wilberforce supposedly asked Huxley whether it was through his grandfather or his grandmother that he claimed his descent from a monkey. Huxley replied that he would rather be descended from an ape than a man who suppressed debate. In 1905, Albert Einstein published an article entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. In it, he introduced the theory of special relativity concerning the relationship between space and time. In 1908, there was a huge explosion in the skies over Siberia. It was believed to have been caused by the breakup of a meteorite. The blast, estimated to have had the force of hundreds of Hiroshima-type atom bombs, caused widespread destruction to the landscape, but no humans are known to have been killed. In 1921, U.S. President Warren Harding nominated William Howard Taft for Chief Justice of the United States. Taft became the only former president to become the head of the High Court. In 1934, German Chancellor Adolf Hitler ordered the purge of the leadership of the Nazi Party's SA paramilitary group. Hundreds are believed to have been executed in what has since become known as the Night of the Long Knives. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Unexploded ordnance, or UXO, bombs, shells, grenades, and landmines, the remains of decades of armed conflict, continue to pose a threat to the people of Laos. The United States is strengthening its commitment by increasing its assistance from $9 million in 2012 and 2013 to $12 million this year. Daniel A. Clune, U.S. Ambassador to the Lao PDR, and Phukia Chantasombon, Director of the National Regulatory Authority, announced the increase on June 6th at the offices of the NRA. Assistance from many countries and the hard work of many organizations have helped decrease casualty from UXO-related accidents in recent years from an average of about 300 per year to a low of 41 in 2013. However, Ambassador Clune pointed out that 41 is still 41 too many. The U.S. began its cooperation with Laos in 1993 with funding to provide victims assistance. In 1996, the U.S. government broadened its assistance program to include clearance and risk education. Since 1993, the U.S. has provided over $70 million in UXO-related assistance to Laos. As in years past, U.S. funding will support cooperation with the NRA, UXO Lao, other humanitarian clearance operators, and international and local organizations. U.S. funds for clearance operations will be focused on provinces seriously impacted by cluster munitions. U.S. support to victims' assistance will provide direct services to survivors of UXO accidents and their families, and also support capacity development of national institutions to provide victims' assistance. Funds will also be used to help strengthen the first aid and emergency response capabilities of key health facilities and village volunteers in heavily impacted provinces. Funding for risk awareness supports educating Lao citizens, especially children, about the dangers of UXO. The U.S. is committed to working with Laos and its international partners in eliminating the threat posed by unexploded ordnance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.